Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. I hope that we've got the connection. I had a little problem here, but I'm going to presume we're on and everything is cool. Okay, today I want to shift a little bit in our discussion on economic issues and talk about political issues, and in particular, the Voting Rights Act decision of this past week, and then pontificate a little bit on the Russia-Ukraine situation and what are some of the scenarios that may reveal here shortly. Okay, let me just begin talking about the voting rights issue here. I recently wrote a blog piece that I would refer you to on my blog, jackrasmus.com. You can also read it on Counterpunch today, title of which is Another Nail in the Coffin of American Democracy. Well, I should say electoral democracy. You know, you got to distinguish between electoral democracy and democracy in general. Electoral democracy, obviously, is about elections and how democratic are your elections. Democracy in general, you know, involves things like the Bill of Rights, you know, the right to assemble, the freedom of speech and organizations and political parties' rights and so forth. So it's a much bigger question. And we know American democracy is not big on democracy outside of the electoral system. But even the electoral system, electoral democracy, has been under great pressure for quite some time here. In my 2020 book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump, I concluded that book with a chapter on the evolution of the decline of American democracy, especially electoral democracy, since 1994. What have been some of the milestones that have been occurring ever since then? You know, the when Newt Gingrich and his right wingers took over the House of Representatives in '94, you know, he outright said that you know, our whole purpose here and strategy is to make government dysfunctional. Yeah, he predicted that, and of course they did. In other words, to roll back any legislation that was popular legislation, progressive legislation, and only let through legislation that was pro-business, pro-capitalist. And to a great extent, he succeeded in that. But that was only the beginning. We saw what happened in 2000 with the election of Gore versus Bush, where the Supreme Court pretty much just gives the presidency to George Bush by stopping the vote in Florida. And, of course, Gore just went along with it after that. We saw that. We've seen the Supreme Court roll back election campaign reform of the 70s, early 80s, since 2000. That's been going on. We saw the Supreme Court gut the Voting Rights Act 1965 here less than a decade ago. We've seen what's going on at the state levels here with the gerrymandering for decades now. And now, of course, it's on steroids, gerrymandering on steroids, now that we got the 2020 census. And the Republicans and the radical wing of Republicans, the Trump Republicans, have garnered pretty much the state legislatures, and they are doing that intensely now for the gerrymandering. The Supreme Court, of course, endorsed the gerrymandering. There have been a number of decisions come before the Supreme Court that have said it's okay to do this gerrymandering, and that has locked in both parties, Republican and Democrat, control of the House of Representatives. There's only maybe 40 seats out of 435 that are really, every time they vote, in contention here. You know, all the rest are nicely gerrymandered to make sure that those two parties stay in office, in the House. So gerrymandering is a big problem, right? And gerrymandering has implications for electoral college results, which we'll talk about. But the Supreme Court, you know, has interjected itself time and time again to endorse and allow the, you know, decline of democracy, not just the gerrymandering, you know, the voter suppression, okaying voter suppression, gutting, as I said, the Voting Rights Act. But, of course, campaign finance reform, most notably Citizens United in 2010, right, which makes corporations, persons, engaging in free speech. Yeah, they have all the rights that individuals, and their free speech takes the form of campaign contributions, you see. So that's locked in the wealthy corporate interests' control of Congress as well. Supreme Court has been, you know, a big factor here in the decline of democracy. People overlook its role in all of this. What's going on at state legislatures, state houses, is a big factor as well. Another, of course, is melding public opinion through social media and even traditional media like Fox News and so forth. That's all part of this decline as well. Public opinion plays a role in democracy and elections and in other areas of government as well. And then we see the transformation of the political parties. Clearly, Republicans have become a kind of a cult for Trump at the base. And that cultish behavior has sort of bled upward into the institutions at the state level and even at the congressional level. Right. So the political party scenario has become more corrupt as well. And of course, you know, the other wing of the capitalist party, the traditionalists who are in the Republican Party are just sitting back and Mitch McConnell and others manipulating that in a very uneasy but an uneasy agreement with the radical right that sometimes is not so uneasy. Trump, of course, and Trump forces are trying to displace some of the traditional Republicans, pro-business Republicans. But there's an uneasy coexistence going on in the Republican Party between those Trump radical right, strong at the base and state level, and traditional pro-business Republicans may be relatively stronger at the congressional level, but there's a coexistence, each manipulating and leveraging each other, which has corrupted the Republican Party, obviously. You know, and then we got the Democrat Party here, where the corporate interests also, over the decades, asserted their control. As I've said on other occasions, we got the Democratic Leadership Conference, the DLC, that pretty much is the corporate wing of that party that took over. It was a faction in the 80s and took over with Bill Clinton and controls that party ever since. And we see the machinations going on in the last several electoral cycles with the corporate wing in that party. Pretty much just you know, exploiting the progressive wing, the popular wing, and dominating and controlling it. And we see how it asserts its control of the Democrat Party here with these Sanders campaigns since 2016 and 20, and manipulating the progressives to get their vote in the election. And then once even agreeing to some of their policies on paper, but then when they're in office, those policies don't go very far. And we saw that with the past year, the Sanders and progressives in the House trying to push some of this legislation, Build Back Better, and how they got outmaneuvered by the corporate wing in their party. Corporate wing, of course, including the Bidens and the Pelosis. Behind them, of course, running interference, the Manchins and Sinemas. Right? That's the corporate wing that you see doing its work in the Democratic Party, ensuring they will never let the progressives get a foothold in the Democratic Party the way the Tea Party or radical Republicans got a strong foothold in the Republican Party. But when we see the atrophying of the Democratic Party going on in recent decades, trying to deal with crises as if they really don't exist and that it's business as usual. In other words, trying to reform the worst of what's going on in terms of policy shifts by the Republicans, doing so timidly and insufficiently and failing. Failing clearly by Obama, and now failing by Biden. And the differences are growing more and more obvious within the Democratic Party. So, in short, what we got is a decay of the political party system going on as part of the broader decay of American democracy that we've been seeing occurring for 25 years now and accelerating as the crises get worse. You know, this long extended war in the Middle East that bled the U.S. Treasury, right? The 2008-09 financial crash that really hampered the U.S. economy, you know, weak, inadequate growth, a recovery from that under Obama. And then we get Trump, bull in a china shop, running around both foreign and domestic policy and breaking all of the wares for sale, pretty much. And then, of course, the COVID hits, and his poor management could not really deal with COVID. And we had this terrible second great contraction of the economy in about a decade, which has fundamentally restructured the U.S. economy in ways that are becoming now only evident. So two big economic crises, you know, a health crisis, a war crisis. And in the midst of all this, Republicans, corporate interest in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party push through a $4.5 trillion tax cut for the rich. So as the crises deepen, their politicians take care of them, at the expense of the rest of the system and the economy. They threw some money at it in its deepest crisis here for people, but then they stopped it and they're starting to take it all back, which is typically what they do after a crisis. You know, throw some money out there to mitigate the worst effects, but then when things settle down, take the money back. That's called austerity. We saw that under Obama, and we will see that here. We will see austerity under the Republicans after 2022. Guaranteed, it will occur once again. It won't occur for the rest of this year. What we've got is kind of the economy moving sideways, slowing down. You know, the big growth spurt reopening it last year is over. It's going to be tougher to get a significant growth rate here. I predict, it's going to slow down to 1-2% here this quarter. GDP growth in the summer may do the same. We will see, but it certainly won't be the 6-7% we saw in the summer last year of GDP growth. So it's going to slow down. Inflation is going to continue. Inflation driven by supply side, supply chain globally, domestic supply, transport problems, a monopoly-like corporations just price gouging going on. So inflation is going to go on, going to slow down the consumer spending already occurring. And the economy growth is going to slow down once again. A scenario not unlike what happened after the 2008-09 crash, where the real economy recovered very slowly, and it took 4 or 5 years to get back where we were, which fueled the radical right, of course, and brought Trump into office. We got the same economic scenario here going on. We're going to have a slowdown of the economy in the wake of the crash here of 2021. Very much similar. You know, what the financial crisis did to the real economy in 2008-09, COVID has done to the economy here in 2020-2021. Okay, different cause, same effect, right? And there's also a possibility we may eventually get to another financial instability event as the Fed raises rates, which it's going to do, is doing already. You know, the economic scenario is in some ways going to be a repeat of what we saw last decade. And with it, the pressure on democracy will continue. This year, of course, we see the collapse of the Voting Rights Act, right? We've seen that. At the same time, behind the scenes, we've got this massive voter suppression spreading through, you know, at least a couple dozen red states, gerrymandering going on everywhere once again, and a Supreme Court that's even more likely to endorse all of this. And we don't see any strategy by Biden and the Democrats to somehow check this this process of electoral democratic dissipation and atrophy that's underway here. It's almost certain that the Democrats are going to lose the House in 2022 midterms. Almost certain. I'd give you any odds on that. Not only because of the Democrats failing to do what they promised to do, and the economy, inflation, and so forth getting worse, right? But because the U.S. 2020 census really favored the Republican red states, they're adding more seats at the expense of some of the blue states. So even if nothing happened, under the best of conditions, the advantage would be to the Republicans in the House in 2022. So, you know, I predict the Republicans will easily win the House. A victory not unlike what happened in 2010, where Obama could not really put forth policies that really rapidly recovered the economy, dithered and focused on tax cuts for corporations here in 2010, and got totally wiped out in the 2010 midterms. You know, massive historic loss of dozens of seats in the House to Democrats. And of course, after that, with control of the House and the Senate, what you got was McConnell saying no, 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 no to everything that Obama might have proposed. By the way, suspending the filibuster to get past pro-business, pro-corporate legislation. You know, this voting rights bill collapse here is tied in with the whole idea of the filibuster, right? The Senate has relied on this Jim Crow Senate rules called the filibuster. You know, the filibuster was introduced during Jim Crow era here in order to allow the Senate to block any reforms that might affect, you know, the status quo in the South. The filibuster was used as a, you know, final vestige of Jim Crow legislation. But it's been suspended 166 times, you know, to allow certain legislation to go through. The last most notable examples of which were every time you've got raising the debt ceiling, making sure the bond owners get their interest, you know, they suspend it. in a simple majority vote. The big example was the 2017 Trump tax cuts, $4.5 trillion over 10 years, that McConnell in control of both houses of Congress here in 2017 simply suspended any filibuster rights and pushed the tax cut through in a couple weeks, I think it was. Democrats totally sidelined in that one. So there's a long history of suspending the filibuster when it suits corporate interests in Congress to do so, and then exercising the filibuster to prevent social legislation or political reform and so forth. I mean, the U.S. Senate, what is it? It's a bastion to protect the system from Democratic impulses that may come in a House. They call it checks and balances. Remember that from your grade school days? Checks and balances are built into the system, right? Well, what's checked is the popular Democratic demands, and what's imbalanced is the interests of corporations and the wealthy. That's what check and balances really are. And that's how it was envisioned, by the way, in the U.S. Constitution of 1787. Yeah, and you read the Constitution Convention discussions, as I have, and that's what they envisioned. They were afraid of the popular forces in the country. They were afraid, the formers of the Constitution, those what 60-some guys who met in Philadelphia, right? Who were mostly merchants and big landowners, slave owners and merchants, they clearly were concerned about what was going on in the 1780s at the state level, which was very revolutionary. After the Revolutionary War ended in 1783, you still had the Articles of Confederation. What we had was uprisings going on at the state level in various states at the time, because we were in a post-war depression, economic depression, and people who had fought the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, wanted to get paid. They didn't get paid, a lot of them, for doing it, or they were paid in script, and after the war they were supposed to then convert that script to real money, or people who loaned money to their state government, that loaned money to the national government to fight the war, they wanted to get paid, but there was no money, you see. The banking system was controlled by the UK, by Britain, right? And when they pulled out, there was no banking system in the U.S. They had to form one, they owed money not only to their people who fought the war, to people who loaned them money domestically, but also to foreign interests, Netherlands and France, that had loaned the U.S. money. They had to pay somehow, pay those bills to get out of the Depression of the 1780s. And that led to these insurrections occurring at state houses. Yeoman farmers would come in and just take over the legislature. No, I think that happened in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and some other places, right? So it was almost a kind of a new revolution on the revolution. We had the political revolution, but there was a social revolution brewing. And that's why the founding fathers met in Philadelphia. By the way, they were instructed by their states only to reform the Articles of Confederation. Instead, they threw them out and they created a new centralized government called the U.S. Constitution. And part of that Constitution was, how do we ensure going forward that we don't continually have these insurrections by the farmers from below? Right? Well, that's why they structured that government in a number of ways. One way was, let's make the House units of representation large. In other words, at the state level, they were kind of small, and anybody who wanted to run for office, could pretty much ride their horse around and get the votes. But if you made the units large, the representation, the House units large, it would be pretty hard to get around everywhere. So it would be pretty hard for some, typical farmer to rise up and represent the people. That's what they did in the House. In the Senate, they made the Senate not elected. You know, they ensured that the senators would be appointed by the state legislatures. And for years and years, that was the case. And, of course, women didn't get the vote, and blacks didn't get the vote, slaves didn't get the vote. There were property requirements, even for whites, to vote. That's how the system was set up in 1787 to ensure the Senate was a bulwark against Democratic movements and impulses in the country. And, of course, then the judiciary. Most Americans aren't aware that the Supreme Court had no right. There was no Supreme Court. There was a judiciary section in the Constitution that said Congress will set up a judiciary. That's all. And Congress then, after 1791, did set up a judiciary, with the Supreme Court that would, rule on appeals. But the Supreme Court never had the authority to declare any law passed by Congress unconstitutional. Never had that authority. It usurped that authority in 1803. The then Chief Justice, Marshall was his name, decided that the Supreme Court, in a famous decision against Madison, had that authority to declare a law unconstitutional. Now, you got to remember who Marshall was. Marshall was the Secretary of State under John Adams, which was a very pro-business government at the time, was defeated by a popular re-revolution, Jeffersonian revolution from below, right? And Adams lost the election. He would not replace, when he went out of office, he would not replace Marshall. And Marshall, as the Secretary of State, got appointed as the Chief Justice by Adams before Adams left office. In other words, they planted a guy in there in the Jefferson cabinet, right? He pays back, the merchant class, which was, behind Adams, with this decision that the Supreme Court can declare law unconstitutional. They were very careful about doing that for decades, but then they, asserted that role after the Civil War. The Supreme Court declared corporations persons in the 1870s, and, decision after decision thereafter. So the Supreme Court, never had the authority to declare anything unconstitutional. It just usurped that authority. Congress went along with it. And Congress can change the legislation to take that away. Of course, powerful corporate business interests don't want to take that away. They want to keep the Supreme Court in their, in their backyard, and they want to make sure the Senate, even though we had a constitutional amendment to have direct election of senators, the response was to throw up all these arcane Senate rules so that the Senate still functions as a bulwark against democracy. Certain laws, at least, certain laws that threaten the interest of the corporate elite. And that brings us back to the Voting Rights Act, in my view. Why are corporate interests using their point person cinema and mansion so intent on maintaining the filibuster, which is the key rule? There's other Senate rules too, but that's the key rule, where they ensure that any real Democratic impulses coming from the House, the more Democratic House, are checked, right? Balanced means thwarted here, right? Checked. Why are Manchin Sinema so adamant about a political issue like voting rights? Why are they so adamant about not passing that? I mean, you could understand how corporate interests manipulating those two people would assert themselves with the Build Back Better Act, because as I've said many times, Build Back Better Act, you know, spending for the people, had to be paid for by raising taxes. In other words, by reversing the Trump tax cuts. So you could see why those corporate interests through those two senators, and of course all the Republicans, were so adamant about not ending the filibuster that would have allowed that act to pass, the Build Back Better, right? I mean, it's more obvious. But what about the Voting Rights Act? Why were the same people so opposed to the Voting Rights Act? Because I think if you shut down the filibuster, it then would only be a matter of time, maybe short time, where you would have enough popular support to repeal the Trump tax cuts to pay for social legislation. They're looking down the road. They know if the filibuster is gone, then democracy returns to the Senate. You know, they can't have that. So I think that's my take of what's behind the corporate wing in the Democratic Party, which is really behind Manchin and Sinema, right? Allied with McConnell, you know, behind why they did not want the Voting Rights Act. Yeah, so it's the tax cuts, stupid. Once again, the mantra of the 90s was, it's the economy, stupid. The mantra of this decade, it's the tax cuts, stupid. Protect those Trump tax cuts, that $4.5 trillion at any cost, you know, even the cost of democracy. Anyway, that's my take of what's going on. But, you know, with the scenario, you look at the Supreme Court and the decisions and the direction it's taken, Supreme Court with no right to rule the way it has, and you look at what's happening at democracy at the state level with the takeover of these state legislatures enabled by the gerrymandering, you know, consequence of which is, you know, rolling, deepening voter suppression going on, gerrymandering, voter suppression, radical right takeover of the state legislatures translates into, you know, what we see going on right now. And of course, the failure of the Voting Rights Act at the congressional level means a further intensification. The door is now open, pretty much, to continue and accelerate forms of voter suppression. Nothing to stop it. You know, the Voting Rights Act would have overruled some of these state anti-democratic voter suppression, maybe even gerrymandering developments. It would have overruled it, you know, because under the Constitution, supremacy clause in the Constitution says federal law takes precedence over state law, right? So now we've got all this voter suppression green light going on and nothing to stop it. And it will be firmly entrenched here for 2022 and even more so by 2024. It does not look good at an institutional level for U.S. democracy, neither at the state level, local level voting, actual voting county by county, where in some of these voting suppression laws, you know, the state legislatures can simply say, oh, we don't want to accept the decision of that county and that county election commissioner. We're throwing that out. We're not going to count that. They can do that now, right? Yeah, they can simply take over. And in some cases, they've already taken over and get rid of these county, particularly in the counties where you have a strong popular vote here democratically. That's going on, and the gerrymandering and that trend is locked in the Trump forces in at least a dozen or more states. So to partially sum up, you know, we see the Supreme Court moving in the direction of anti-democracy. We see the state legislatures moving very quickly. We see failure at the national level to contain and check that development. Voter suppression and gerrymandering going on. We see the corruption of the political parties, both the Republican in a certain way and the Democrats in a certain way. They will not let the progressive wing assert itself. Which, by the way, to digress, proves this whole Sanders inside-outside strategy. You know, the Democratic Party's been a total failure. What he does next, you know, will remains to be seen. I don't think he's going to do anything next here except the talk, rail against it, you know, which is what Biden is doing. What is he doing? He's saying, oh, we're not going to give up here. This is just, we're going to continue fighting, you know, even though we lost the vote, you know. And then, of course, he doesn't say how. What's he going to do? What's he going to do now that he lost the vote? Oh, we're going to not give up. What the hell does that mean if you don't say how you're not going to give up, right? And Sanders comes out and he says, we were tricked for 5 months. You know, Manchin and Sinema dangled in front of us, you know, what they might do, and then they did nothing, you know. We were manipulated. Well, Bernie, it took you 5 months to see that? Come on, it was obvious. Obvious since last summer and even before, when you pared down your legislation in March, right? And then you pared it down again, agreed to it again in July. And then the progressive wing agreed to vote up the infrastructure bill first, which meant at that point, they had no leverage and they were dead in the water. And that was the end of Build Back Better, right? Yeah. I mean, you guys couldn't see that coming? I mean, either you're lying to us or you're totally naive and inept. One or the other, you know? I don't know which one is more the case here, progressives in the House or the Sanders movement in the Senate. Anyway, progressivism is dead. It's D-O-A. It's gone. And now you can see that in the Democratic Party. You know, now the big movement, the spin is, oh, to blame the progressives, to blame Sanders for the failure of these bills. In other words, the spin is now, oh, you know, we went too far here. We got out of touch with the country and we put forward legislative proposals that were not acceptable to the country. You know, the progressives set us up for this defeats of these bills. In other words, blame someone else, point the finger somewhere else, because you, the Democrat leadership, would not do what needs to be done, would not really corral your Manchin's and Sinema's, right? Do nothing to put pressure on them. You know, you went along with the game, and they knew it, and they kept playing it, right? Oh, but it's not your fault. No, it's Sanders and the progressives' fault, you know? Point the finger, right, is what they're doing here. And that message is going to gain momentum. You can see it already being picked up by the media and other sources, you know, blaming the progressives, you know? Progressives gave Biden their vote, put him in office, right? And now they're being blamed for the failure of the Democratic leadership to pass the progressive legislation, which, by the way, was not all that progressive. I mean, this was typical Democrat Party legislation of the past, right? It wasn't that radical. But ever since the DLC corporate wing took over, you know, they say it is quite radical. So we got an atrophying of the corruption and decaying of the political party system. We've got gerrymandering. We got voter suppression. We got a Supreme Court endorsing it all and moving right. And it's only really begun to move right now. You'll see how far that's going to go. And then you got social media cancer whipping up public support for the right wing going on in this country. It's a concoction that you can only conclude will continue further, right? All these corruptions of democracy going on in the U.S. right now clearly will continue, and they're now beginning to feed back and reinforce each other. So the scenario is not all that pretty for American democracy. At the same time, you know, we have those forces behind Trump who tried to steal the election here in 2020 did it very clumsily and ineptly, kind of like the way Trump runs his company. Companies, you know, he ran the country the same way, and he ran his challenge the same way. He's not very effective, you know. What did we see? What did we see? Just to recoup, you know, what happened in November, December of 2020, culminating in the January 6th insurrection, the desperate move by Trump here, you know. Will we see any of that again? I think so. I think so. Unless, of course, the Republican right just totally swamps the Democrats, which could be the case, then you won't see the coup, the legal coup. It won't be necessary. But, you know, it might be necessary. And think of what happened in November, December as kind of a dress rehearsal for a more skilled, clever legal coup that could very well happen in the future in this country. Well, what did happen? Well, very clearly, you know, the first thing Trump did was try to file these court cases to stop the election count in those key swing states. That did not turn out very well. His fallback strategy by early December was clearly to, behind the scenes, get state-level election officials and or Republican governors to simply not recognize the electors that were elected. You know, Electoral College is that other great bastion of containing democracy, like the Senate and the Supreme Court, right? So what the strategy was to get these governors or election officials not to recognize the elected electors, right? Which meant that the governors would either not endorse the electors and would send a separate set of electors to Congress on January 6th that were pro-Trump, right? Or not send any at all, which means the electors of those states, particularly swing states, would not get counted. That was the whole strategy, to manipulate the Electoral College so the electors for Biden would not get counted on January 6th. Well, what happened was, the state governors balked at doing that. Some of the Republican state governors balked. What happened was you got the electors sent to Congress, because part of the election, you see, has to be endorsed. The president is not elected until Congress says so. You know, all you need is for Congress on January 6th not to say so. And it doesn't matter what the popular vote was. It wouldn't be. And then the next step would be for Congress to wheel and deal among itself to determine who the president might be, or whether you need a new election or whatever. It would be thrown into the House of Representatives. And the decision of the House of Representatives would not be based upon the weight of population in the different states, but each state would get one vote. You see, that's the way the election rules work in that kind of situation. Each state get one vote. And if you have a majority of the states under your control because of gerrymandering and voter suppression, right? You got the representatives, you got a majority of your Tea Party right-wing red Trump Republicans, right? Then that state would vote for, you know, whatever they decided. Would it be, the Speaker of the House? Or would it be, the vice president? We don't know. The Constitution's unclear about that, you see? But the point is, if you got that far, one state, one vote. And if you got a majority of small states in your pocket, well, then you control the vote in the Congress for who would be the president. That was the whole idea, you see. At the very last step of all this, Vice President Pence was supposed to refuse to accept the votes for the electoral representation for the swing states. He was supposed to balk and say, no, we're not going to see, I don't approve, or however he was going to read it out, who knows, Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin, right, or Georgia or Arizona, right? No, I don't approve that. Then, of course, you would not have had a majority of Electoral College votes by Biden to be declared the president. You might even had a majority in left for Trump. I don't know what that count was. I think he had 230 Electoral College votes around there, and Biden had 270s. So if you if Pence simply refused to agree to counting, because he was the one counting out the votes there, he was in the key position, refused to allow the count of that electoral representation from those swing states, well, then it would have thrown the whole thing up, you know, into a flux, and then you're on totally new ground, never traveled before as to how you select the president at that point. So the key was manipulating the Electoral College. And we saw very clearly how they can do that now. It's very obvious, right? You simply don't allow the electoral majority in the state for your opponent to go forward and get counted, right? Or you send another delegation instead to Congress, or you let both delegations go to Congress, you see? And in either case, what you got is, well, we can't count. You know, Pence can't count that state. There's just a dispute as to who the electoral representatives are, right? Oh, we have to adjudicate that. Well, we can't do it now, so, you know, what do we do? Well, we don't count those electors from that state, you see? If you didn't have an electoral college, none of that would be a question. None of it. You know, it would simply be, okay, we got the total number of votes. You know, that's it. Well, you know, Trump wasted time by filing all of his legal charges in state courts, and then he had to fall back to this desperate manipulate the electoral representation sent to Congress approach. And then, of course, January 6th was an attempt to intimidate Pence and Congress to somehow declare all of this unresolvable on January 6th and adjourn and try to figure out what happens next. And then, of course, he could have a chance at manipulating what happens next. But it got out of hand. You know, you had a lot of neo-fascists in that group who thought it was an opportunity to, you know, smash windows and invade the Capitol, you know, naive dumbasses who think that's what revolution is all about, right? Insurrection, take over a building, you know? Pretty dumb. The right wing's pretty dumb, but pretty dangerous at the same time. You know, if someone cleverly gets to mobilize them, but then you got a big problem. Okay, so that's what January 6th was about, intimidation. But it got out of hand, right? Will the January 6th committee ever reveal the politicians who played a role? I don't believe so. You'll never see that. At least the public won't. It might get sealed somewhere, you know, in the archives. Just as, by the way, the attempted coup in 1934 against FDR, in which you had some big capitalists involved. There were hearings on it, right? Yeah, they tried to take over in 1934. It didn't work. The generals revealed it all. And the hearings got sealed. And you still can't read those hearings, you see. They got sealed, that coup attempt in 34. Well, you know, what'll happen? The real evidence here will get sealed again in the January 6th committee. But it will show that, you know, there are high-level Republicans deeply involved in planning and financing, you know, what big corporations finance this, in the whole coup attempt. The coup attempt, of course, was not the, you know, the dummies breaking windows and entering the Capitol building. The coup attempt was going on the floor of Congress, you know. But for whatever reasons, Pence lost his nerve. He didn't go along with it. You know, if some of the state Republican governors had been more cooperative and sent, double delegations, right, or refused to send one delegation and appointed another, Pence probably would have seen, oh, this is likely, you know, I'll go along with it. But, it was poorly, quickly, and erratically organized by Trump, and there wasn't enough support for it, and for Pence to go along with it. But next time, they won't make those mistakes. Next time. Okay, so that's my review of the continuing decline of American democracy, particularly electoral democracy, going on institutionally, going on in public opinion, going on in the political parties, and, going on in electoral college and at the state level. And all of it is converging here. It's not going away, you know. And the big defeat is the inability at the national level to pass Voting Rights Act to check all that. Okay. I want to say a few words about what's going on in Ukraine here in conclusion, right? What we got is this potential for an imminent invasion by Russia of Ukraine, right? Will it happen? Well, I kind of think, you know, there's been some understanding between Biden and the Russians here that Biden kind of let slip we're probably going to see a partial invasion. In other words, the Russians are going to send all their tanks and drive onto Kiev and take the city. That's not likely. What's likely is they will solidify their control in the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces in the east. They may even cross the border and stop, you know. Possible scenarios more like what happened a decade or so ago in Georgia, where, forces in the U.S., Bush and McCain and others encouraged the then U.S. puppet in Georgia to invade South Ossetia province in Russia. And then the Russians, of course, just quickly moved back and invaded in turn Georgia itself, but stopped. They didn't go on to the capital, Tbilisi, but they took over a province here, Abkhazia, and took over South Ossetia, no doubt. And then stopped and neutralized the effectiveness of that government, and then long term have been working at ensuring that there was at least a neutral Georgian government. I think something like that is on in the works with the Ukraine here. If Russia invades, I think it will be just crossing the border and sort of signaling, saying, hey, look, you know, we can do this. If we really want, you want to sit down and really negotiate? Because what the Russians want, first and foremost, the only real demand is no NATO in Ukraine. No NATO. Because if NATO's there and they invade, then all of NATO has to turn against them. They want to prevent NATO from coming in. The Ukrainian government and fascists there really want NATO in as a protection against Russia, but Russia's not going to do that. Russia is not going to give up the Ukraine without a shot, right? Protecting its southern flank without a shot after it lost 20 million people in World War II defending the Ukraine against the Nazis, right? The political civilian advisors in the U.S. that always push the U.S. towards a war since they don't have to fight it, totally underestimate where Ukraine sits in the Russian psyche. The Russians will never allow NATO to take a foothold in the Ukraine. They won't allow it. They'll take whatever risk they have to prevent it. You know, they already allowed it in the Baltics, and they're seeing the consequences of that, NATO in the Baltics. They can't do anything about that because now it's NATO. But they can do something about the Ukraine before it becomes NATO. And I think the Russians, you know, most likely a 60-40 chance will cross the border, but will not do, and then will stop, kind of like what they did in Georgia. Right? And then they'll stop. And then, you know, it becomes a negotiation. We'll pull back. If you then give us a written agreement, you will not bring NATO into the Ukraine. Okay? Then, you know, they'll pay a price. They'll pay a price for doing that. But to them, you know, the political long-term historical consequences are too great. They will pay whatever economic price they have to, in my opinion. The U.S. may want to provoke a situation in Ukraine, you see, because some of the European countries economically and politically have been drifting away from NATO and sort of drifting into an independent role, and the U.S. doesn't want that. What a greater way to unify NATO than to have a crisis in Ukraine. And some of the East European countries like that because, you know, they'll be able to get more arms from the United States. You know, Poland and some of the others, they like that. So there's forces in the U.S. and in Europe pushing towards, yeah, let's have a little bit of a crisis in Ukraine here. It'll strengthen our position and NATO itself. And then there's also the issue the U.S. has been quite concerned for several years now about Germany becoming dependent on Russian gas, natural gas, right? Yeah, the U.S. wants to sell its natural gas surplus to Germany. It doesn't want them going to Russia to get it. So, you know, if there's a crisis and the natural gas issue becomes moot, and Germans have to buy more U.S. natural gas. So, you know, the big U.S. oil companies like that idea, and they see that the only way you break Germany and Europe off of Russian natural gas dependency is to maybe have a crisis. So there are forces, both government and non-government in the U.S., that want to see a crisis in the Ukraine, but not one that gets out of hand, you know? That's why I think Biden will accept some kind of a tentative, temporary invasion that clears his hand for, okay, we got the Russians to pull back. Okay, you got it because you agreed no NATO in Ukraine, you see. That's a scenario I see as most likely going to occur here, a scenario not unlike what happened with Georgia a decade or so ago, right? Will the U.S. impose sanctions? Yeah, I mean, likely what you'll see is more financial imperialism. The U.S. will try to cut Russia off of the SWIFT international payment system, which is necessary to buy and sell oil on the global market. You know, controlled by the U.S., which is key to its sanctions, you know, visibility after sanctions work. And you got to control the SWIFT international payment system. SWIFT is an acronym, SWIFT, S-W-I-F-T. And, you know, we'll see what happens if they do that. Probably will accelerate China and Russia developing its own payment system. You know, that's my take on what's going on in foreign policy right now. And the right wing in the U.S. will try to manipulate this to undermine Biden even more, which probably will work for domestic electoral purposes. You know, Biden will have to do something, as he's promised to do. But, you know, there's some benefits looking tough here on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Anyway, we'll watch that one. That's an interesting development going on here. Nothing to watch much more on the decline of the U.S. democracy, except at the state level and the Supreme Court level, now that the Voting Rights Act has been shut down. Okay, that's it for today. I'm out of here.